Hello, I'm Russ Cowage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, challenges and triumphs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And my special guest today is Dr. Ian Rabinowitz, who I've known for over a decade now. Ian, would you like to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Firstly, I'm not as fit as you would imagine, but I'm originally from South Africa. I did my medical school in South Africa. I came to the United States in 1986 and went to my residency and my fellowship in the United States. And eventually in 1997, I landed up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I've worked in the cancer center in Albuquerque, New Mexico for 26 years now.
What was your job there? So imagine everyone's listening. It's like you're an oncologist, right?
That's great. So the thing is, I've had many subspecialty roles because what would happen is I did leukemia for a while, but then leukemia doctors came in. And they sort of pushed me to another job. I was a breast cancer doctor for a while, but now I got pushed to something else. So I've covered every part of hematology and oncology, except for gynecologic malignancies, because we have a gyn-onc group here that takes care of uterine, ovarian, and cervical cancer. So basically, I've done everything. My most recent, I don't know if it's interest, but was the brain tumors.
Wow.
I count brain tumors recently.
I think when I first met you, you were the thoracic lead, but you are the kind of, you know, MVP of the cancer center. And it's like, you know, send in Rabinowitz because no one else wants to do the job.
Something like that. I'd say that over time, that would be a true statement, yeah.
But you also ran the clinical trials unit, is that right?
Yep. For some time, I'm a sort of a chameleon. I ran the clinical trial thing. For, I've been here 26 years. So I've done a lot of things. I was interim chief of the division for 2 years and then retired, and then I came back a little bit later. But at that time, I didn't like it and just sort of gave up that job.
And then you ran the fellowship program as well?
Yeah, I did that for about 15 odd years. And recently in 2018, a colleague of mine took over. I'm sort of the deputy director of the fellowship program. So I've always been involved in the teaching of the program, yeah.
I mean, maybe we should tell the audience how we first met, or I can't remember if we had interacted professionally before our special relationship developed, or whether you just reached out to me directly. Can you recall?
I reached out to you directly because of my illness.
Spoiler alert, let's jump into that. So,
I apologize. Well, what happened was I was doing well, and I had a seizure in one of the examination rooms.
So you were in your clinic, and you had a seizure?
A grand mal seizure. The patient ran out the room, and a whole lot of people apparently came in to the room. I got CPR by a colleague. Broke a few ribs. Then I was taken to the ER. They did a CT scan of my brain, as well as some cardiac stuff. And they thought they saw something in my brain, but they weren't quite sure. I was admitted into the hospital, and overnight I had an MRI of the brain. In the morning, a neurology resident walks in and says, "Everything looks fine. You got some hemangiomas in your brain." 2 minutes later, the attending walks in and says, "You have metastatic cancer to your brain."
Oh, wow. That's quite the roller coaster ride in two minutes.
There was quite a bit of a change in being happy and then not being so happy. And I said to the attending, "I just want to let you know that your resident just told me I'm fine." She says, "I know about that, so I'm going to talk to her." They found a mediastinal mass and a small lymph node in my left lung. And they tried to get a biopsy of the small nodule. There was one centimeter in size, but they gave me a pneumothorax instead. Yeah, it was really nice.
It's a small aside. So you're waking up and, you know, you started the day as a physician and you end up the day as a patient. Now, this might sound a weird question. Are you actually enjoying the process of seeing things from the other side, or is it terrifying?
I thought it was going to, you know, with brain metastasis and I've got to tell you, I had bone lesions as well as with this mediastinal mass. So I thought I've got 3 to 6 months to live. Well, I didn't know that I had a mutated lung cancer. I thought it was your general type, even though I've never been a smoker. And I was 52 at the time.
How old are you now, Ian?
65.
So it's funny, I've treated a lot of physicians as patients. And I remember some of them, not all of them, but some of them say, well, I always wondered what a CT scan was like, and now I've had one, and it was really interesting.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I may have had one before. I think I had a CT scan for a kidney stone a few years ago before that.
Yes, but it's probably somewhat less scary than what you were going through.
Yeah, no, for sure, yeah.
So during that hospital admission, did you get the final diagnosis, or did they just say there's stuff in your brain and we're still figuring out where it comes from?
No, I didn't get the diagnosis, but they said it looks like lung cancer because of the mediastinal mass.
Okay.
The nodule in the lung, brain lesions, and bone lesions.
And so at that point in time, how do you choose who your doctor is? Because you're working in the cancer center and you know all of them, good and bad.
Yeah. Well, we had a Julie Bauman, who knew you, was the lung cancer doctor at that time. She subsequently chose to be an ENT doctor. But she was there and she took over the case. We organized for me to get a mediastinoscopy after the CT guided needle biopsy that showed that lung cancer was very hard tissue. And the thoracic surgeon said that he's never had such hard tissue to take out. Just took a piece out. They then sent it for pathology, and they found that it was a ALK positive translocation.
You know, you're a physician, and physicians classically, you know, it's like go, go, go. You know, you've got your clinic, you've got your patients lined up, and then this complete wrench is thrown in the machine. So what do? Do you just say cancel everything? You know, you had young adult children at that time.
Yeah.
Marina, your wife was there. I mean, how did you manage all of that?
Well, my daughter was already in college. She had gone to college. My son was still in high school. But my daughter came back, and everyone that I knew, that I'd ever known, came to Albuquerque to say their last goodbyes.
Yes, before you go. They're probably disappointed you're still here.
And I am Jewish. And I had 3 or 4 rabbis come by to give me their condolences and their advice about how I go through this process. And one of them was decent, the others were terrible.
What was the difference between the decent one and the terrible ones?
The decent one spoke to me like I was still alive and, you know, said, you know, live your life as well as you can. These things happen. You know, he was quite down to earth. The others were like giving me this thing about, oh, you're going to go to heaven if you've been a good person, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? But everyone came, and even people that didn't really know very well, they came by to say bye.
And physically, were you functional? I mean, you'd had the seizure to recover from the seizure.
No, I was fine. I sort of paid more attention to how I felt, because before I was just walking around and doing everything without any, this came on very suddenly. It wasn't like I had weakness or numbness or any confusion. It just came on, boom. I was a little bit more off kilter, so to speak.
You mean in steadiness on your feet?
No, just in my mind, because now all of a sudden I had this cancer.
So you get this diagnosis of cancer. You're an oncologist. You know what it means in the best, but your mind usually goes to the worst place.
Yeah.
I mean, do you just cancel all your clinics? What are you talking about with Marina at home during these first few days?
Well, the first thing we went to do is go to the finance people to see how much money I had, because she had a job, but it wasn't a well-paying job. It was a job that was okay, to see, you know, how much did I have and what was my life insurance and things like that. We did a lot of that type of activity. I wasn't really worried about Marina. I was worried about my kids.
Yeah.
Because they were still relatively young.
Were you professional, as much as that's the right word, about this? You know, were you objective about it? Or at some point, there's got to be I know oncology, but this is me, and all the things I'd planned for next week and next year, I now have to rethink.
Ross, I'm going to tell you, when I was young, when I was a teenager, I used to write three things on my jeans. And my mom would go wash them off, and I would rewrite them. It's all relative. Nothing makes a difference. And it was one more. I can't remember.
It'll come back to you.
It'll come back to me. Everyone thought I was crazy. I had this mind where I, at a very young age, I realized to dust to dust, that life is terminal. So I sort of kept that in my mind, despite seeing what I saw as a doctor as a reality. So when I found out I was now a patient, I just said, okay, now I'm the person who's dust to dust. I don't think I was crying or very upset. I was just worried about my kids and Marina. The other thing is, I should tell you that my father died at the age of 62, also of lung cancer, not because of smoking, but he had a collapsed lung, and I saw him die.
It must have been hard not to imagine yourself in the situation you saw your father in.
Yeah, I was, but I wasn't in this situation here. Malignant pleural effusion. He was much sicker. He's in South Africa, so care wasn't so good.
Whilst it sounds like you had a kind of classic stoic reaction, you know, stuff's going to happen. And even just from our conversation here and from conversations in the past, you've always been very upfront about the significance of the diagnosis. How were your wife and kids? Did they share that meaning, or were they kind of like, okay, I'm going to let you talk, but I don't like hearing you talk about this?
Marina was, you know, she's get to business, let's get things done. She's that type of person. So she was, okay, we've got to get the life insurance, we've got to get this done, we've got to get this done. So where are we going to bury you? That type of thing. So I was saying, okay, well, you know, who knows what's going on. But by that time, I think I already had found out that I had a ALK translocation.
Okay.
So about a week later, I found out that I had an ALK translocation. And we had just opened up a clinical study comparing crizotinib to standard chemotherapy for metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.
Yeah, was that the first-line study?
It was a first-line study.
That was Profile 1014. Wow.
Well, you got a good memory.
Well, I did, and that was part of what I made my career on. But
she said, "You want to go on the study?" I said, "Sure, no problem." I first had some radiation to my brain, whole brain radiation, which made me feel, I don't think it made me feel better, but it made me feel more comfortable.
Just psychologically, that you've done something?
Yeah, because I wasn't having any symptoms from the brain tumor, but psychologically, I was, you know, am I going to have another seizure soon?
There must have been more than one deposit in the brain if they gave whole brain.
No, there was about 10. And the radiation therapist, looking back, he may have done SBRT on them, but at that time he just went ahead and did all of the whole brain.
This is 2011. So in 2011, and this is the same true with everything in medicine, you can only work with the facts that you have at the time.
Yeah, I was totally comfortable with what he did, and we've, you know, always been friends in a way. We've always had a good time laughing together about different things.
I mean, that's an interesting segue. How did your colleagues deal with it? Did they want to put you in a patient bucket? You know, because now suddenly you've got a foot in both camps.
Yeah. That's a good question. I think they put me back to work pretty quickly.
That sounds like you didn't have a choice in the matter. The slave labor.
I think they said, they asked me what I wanted to, and I said, I want to go back to work.
Okay.
I'll be sitting in a corner thinking about things that I don't want to really think about.
You mean this is if you don't go back to work?
I don't go to back here. If I go back to work, I'm filling my day doing what I do and not really worrying about the cancer. Put it to the side.
I remember you told me at the time that one of the things that you changed up was, you know, you had some research roles as well, and you initially dropped all the research and concentrated on the clinical. Is that right?
I think it's most probably true. Yeah, yeah.
So you may not remember telling me this, but this is what I remember, which is you said to produce results in research might take 5 years, and I don't know if I've got 5 years, but I can make a patient better tomorrow.
Well, it's not about making them better, but yeah, trying to help them today and tomorrow. Yeah, so I must probably say that. That's very possible, yeah.
It made a big impression on me. I mean, I thought that's very true and is really the heart of being a physician.
Yeah. I think what happened when I went back to work, you know, firstly, I thought I was going to die. So I was very tentative in how I was approaching my work. But once I got through the first while and realized that this wasn't going to be a very short time, I realized I should get back to work and do the work that I should be doing. And I started telling patients about my story. They had metastatic disease. I wouldn't tell someone with polycythemia vera that I had metastatic cancer, but I'd tell someone with metastatic whatever cancer about my story. And they took it very well. And I'd also tell them how I sort of dealt with it. And I said that, you know, when you've got cancer and you know it's not curable, you have some time left. That everyone, children have some time left, but people who don't have cancer or a bad illness, it's in their brain, it's up here, they're thinking about it. If you've been told you've got a serious illness that's going to take you in a fairly near period of time, it becomes in the heart and in the soul. It's a different way of thinking about life. It's a different way of thinking about your existence and how you're going to go through it. And one of the things that I learned is that the worst thing to do is to sit around and wait for that moment to come. You've got to get up and find meaning in your life. You've got to find something to do that's going to give you the meaning to continue. And then you forget about the cancer. You live your life as best you can, whether it's going to a food pantry, whether it's going to an elderly home to help out, whether it's, if you're religious, go to the church, help out in the church or whatever. You've got to find meaning in your life. You can't just sit around all day and watch TV because that's meaningless. Your life's not really meaningful anyway. So yeah, then who cares? But if you want to make your life meaningful, you've got to go out and do something meaningful.
I mean, there's always this barrier is too strong a word, between patients and their physicians where we're friendly, but we're not friends.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you revealing this intimacy, did that feel weird? I mean, did it feel natural at the time?
Until recently, it's been very natural. And people have asked me how I'm doing. Is it how I said, how they do? I mean, I don't do as much now as I did in the beginning because I sort of forgot that I had cancer to a large degree because I was busy doing the things that I've been doing in this clinic. But I still do it once in a while. If I see a patient who feels a bit fragile, psychologically, mentally, whatever, and is having a difficult time with the diagnosis, I'll tell them my story. And then I'll say, this is how I think you should go about living your life, because if you just sit in a corner and watch TV, it's not worth me giving you any treatment anyway. But I can say it with some fortitude or something, because I tell them I have the same disease and I've been dealing with this for X amount of years. And this is what I've learned.
Did you ever wonder whether you should take on new patients, given that you didn't know what your shelf life was going to be?
Maybe in the beginning, but after a year or so, 2 years, certainly after being in debt for a while, I never crossed my mind. I just kept on taking patients and just working.
I remember we shared a couple of patients, which was delightful because I think one of your patients used to refer to me as her oncologist's oncologist. So we talked about how initially when you're diagnosed, you know, you pause about taking on new patients because you don't know how long you're going to do.
Yeah.
But then as you show that you're doing well and perhaps outliving many of your patients, how do you process that too?
I process that like a normal doctor would. There's some patients that really get to you. And you mourn for them, you go to their funeral, their memorials. Most of them you don't, because firstly, it's overwhelming. The few patients where I really was so close to was like they could have been my brother or sister. But most of the patients are patients who I have a good relationship with. But I had to have some barriers, just like every physician has to, especially oncologist has to have barriers to protect themselves from being locked down every time they see a patient.
There's the balance between staying vulnerable enough that you can relate to your patients, but not so vulnerable that you're destroyed every time something bad happens.
Yeah. There were one or two patients where I was destroyed that most of the time I had barriers.
In terms of day-to-day life, how much does your cancer and the treatment and surveillance of your cancer affect you?
So this has been almost coming up to 13 years. One thing, it's many different types of my life. I would say for the most part, it hasn't really affected me. I've had a lot of scans done, MRIs, PET scans, too many to count. So I'm used to them, but I still don't like getting scans. I'd say that's the one regret I had of having cancer, besides going to die earlier than I should or would. Just having too many scans, it was a lot.
And you don't like them because you're claustrophobic or you're worried about the x-rays or it's a reminder that you've got cancer?
Yeah, I wasn't claustrophobic. I don't like getting scans. Most of them were sort of unchanged, although there were some that showed progression of disease, and then you get a little bit upset about it. But you say, oh, well, maybe this is the time when things are going to go south. But I kept on working, and I got radiation to my brain in 2022 because I had a nodule in my left posterior part of my brain. The nodule's still there. It hasn't really shrunk down. It's relatively stable. Otherwise, I think having cancer, the one thing that's happened is when we've gone on trips somewhere, I find it difficult to climb up rocks and things like that. My balance is not as good as it used to be. And I think it's related in part to the brain tumors and I don't know what else, but I took vitamin B12 for a while. That didn't really help, and some routine neurologic thing, studies done, but I don't have a good balance trying to walk up a normal. I can walk for quite a long time, you know, on a road, but if you get me walking, trying to walk up a mountain, doing a hike, I'm not good.
In October 2023, you stopped seeing patients, is that right?
Yeah. So what happened was, and unbeknownst to me, I was called in and told my memory wasn't good. And this was coming from the pharmacy people primarily. And I think I think my mid-level or someone in that area was saying that my memory wasn't good. I was mixing up the medications and stuff like that. I thought, okay, this is it. They're going to fire me. Let me go because I have no use in this place. So I was a bit nervous about that, and then I went to see the chief of our division. We spoke for a while, and she said, you know what, you can become a peer educator and a peer researcher, trying to help the fellows with research. And so I said, yeah, that'll be fine. We won't see any patients anymore. And all my patients went to the other doctors. Yeah, I thought that's going to be a bit of a tough thing for me because I really felt my work was my patients. And I thought that this would really make me a little bit upset about coming to work and that. But turns out that it's not too bad for me. I'm enjoying it. I'm trying to change the fellowship program a little bit, make it a little bit more stringent. It's got a bit of slack, I think. I might try to get projects for research for patients, change the fellowship program around. I want to try give the fellows an opportunity to experience AI and go to the main campus. They maybe can spend 6 months working in an AI lab, not really doing the work, but being there and experiencing it so they get a real sense of what AI is, because I think that's going to be important looking forward.
You also turned 65 about the same time, so it was a sort of double whammy.
Yeah, it definitely was. Also, I have to say, I don't know how long I'm going to keep going with this. I mean, I think I feel fine for the most part. I'm enjoying what I'm doing now. There's less stress in my life in terms of not having to keep up with charts and calling up patients and this and that, which you have to do. I still have to every day come in, check my medical records to make sure that, there's a lot of orders that were put in 6 months ago or so. So I've got to look at them. If they're abnormal, I'll send them to the person who's taken over the patient for me. Otherwise, I'll just delete the results of like a blood test or a scan or whatever.
Were there patients that you personally told, or just the administration sort of moved them
over? The administration just told them, yeah. I do it too many people for me to go and say, now the administration. I've spoken to quite a few patients since that time.
Did this come out of the blue, or were you aware of memory issues yourself?
I thought I was compensating for it. You've always had a bad memory, but apparently not well enough.
I mean, one of the things, as I said, you know, you can't change the past, but the whole brain radiotherapy, because you've done so well, you know, these late potential side effects, you know, plus all of the other stuff that's gone on, you know, you have lived long enough for some of them to catch up with you.
I understand that 100% about radiation therapy, whole brain, also SBRT, and about chemotherapy. With scans, the MRIs, I don't know if they make a difference, but the amount of MRIs I've had may have had some effect, I don't know. And I'm 65, as you say, and I never had a good memory.
I can't remember if I told you this, but I have a patient who, similar to you, has been going for a long time, and every time, you know, he gets some new symptom, he goes, is it the disease? Is it the medication? Or am I just getting older? If we're lucky, the major side effect of cancer treatment in the future will be, you know, getting older.
Yeah. What I can say, and I really honestly mean this, I am blessed to have lived this extra 12, coming up to 13 years, and have been with my family, my wife and that, but I'm also blessed to see how far medicine has come with all these new crisps. It's just amazing to me what's happened in the last 12 to 13 years. Yeah, PD-1s, and I think PD-1s were around at that time.
They were just being presented at conferences when you were diagnosed. None of them were licensed.
Yeah, it wasn't a standard treatment. It's been an amazing experience with all these advances.
What I notice is when I talk to you, you know, yeah, you're 13 years older than when I first, you know, met you, but you're still you. You're still very much you. And I'm, you know, wondering how many patients you personally have helped in those 13 years, just from being a good doctor and from sharing some of your story.
Yeah. And also medical residents and that, they're kind of a lot of teaching as well.
Do you tell the fellows your diagnosis? Are they aware of that?
I have, but it's not that I personally go and said I expect everyone to know it because they can talk among themselves. But I just had a first year fellow I'm doing a project with come in and I said, "So you know that I've got metastatic cancer?" He said, "No, I didn't." I said, "Well, let me tell you."
But is that kind of like ripping the Band-Aid off? I mean, when you have to tell someone again, is it fresh?
No, like not for me. It's more of a, I want to connect with you a little bit more, so let me tell you my story. Then I want to connect with the fellow a little bit more, so he needs to know who I am. My daughter is a geophysicist, married an English geologist. They're in Seattle. My son, who's an electrical chemist, did his PhD at Stanford.
Right.
He's at, also got an English, learning with an English girl for the last 3 to 5 years, because she also was there doing the program. So I've got a lot of connections with the Brits.
We make fabulous partners, what can I say?
They're wonderful. They're really wonderful.
I wonder what you see yourself doing over the next few years.
Well, assuming I stay alive, et cetera, this losing, having a tangible loss of memory. It's, I'm still reading Cell, Nature, and Science, because that's where I get my research projects from. So there may come a time where they'll say to me, "You know what, Dr. Rabinowitz, thanks for your service. We think, it's better that you leave." I then I should probably go with Marina, spend more time with our kids, although they're working full time and really working hard, but we can spend weekends with them and watch their dogs for the weeks, go to seas on vacations and do things like that. That's sort of way I think that'd be. I'd like to read. I used to love reading books. Don't know how much I can read a book right now, but I think I read most of the books I want to read. I've done all the classics. And I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know where I'll be in 2 or 3 years from now.
Well, if I take your advice and give it back to you, you have to find something to do. You can't just sit in the corner watching TV.
But right. Thank you for that, Russ.
It just proves I listen to you.
I might go, help out young kids with math or science, because I love those two subjects. And I don't know if anyone will take me. I could try help out in going to feeding shelter and helping out there. I don't know what I'll do. I'm not sure.
I think whatever you do, you will be giving back in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great time to pause. I'm going to wish you the best of luck with whatever the future does bring. Ian, thank you so much for sharing your story. You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Camage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or follow us at DR Camage on X for additional commentary.